Genesis 35, let's start there. Here's what we've established so far. In our study of the book of Romans, we bumped into Paul's argument about circumcision. The circumcision debate runs rampant through the church. There are a lot of theories, there's a lot of theology, there's a lot of errant thinking running around about circumcision, what it signifies, and what the importance of it is. Paul is going to talk a lot about circumcision and a lot about Abraham, the promises of Abraham, the forefathers, all that kind of stuff, and God's dealings with Israel in particular as we continue through Romans. So we decided to take a few weeks and establish some basic Israelology so that we would understand circumcision, what the Bible actually says about it, and that we would understand who the forefathers are, and so that we would understand God's dealings with Israel in a very overview, broad kind of sense. So that's what we've been doing. We got as far as showing that God chose Abraham, who was an idol worshiper in Ur of the Chaldees, and that he chose him in particular and gave him a promise that was said to be everlasting. Last week we got up to how many repetitions of that promise? Seven? Or did we hit eight last week? The exact same promise, seven, eight times, promised exactly the same way to Abraham. It included possessing the gates of his enemies. It included possessing all the land of Canaan. It included those that curse you, I'll curse. Those that bless you, I'll bless. It included you'll have children as the sands of the seas and stars of the heaven. And it included that through you and your seed, all the nations of the world will be blessed. That promise we saw last week was given to Abraham, well, 2 weeks ago, given to Abraham in an unconditional sense. God passed through and made a covenant with himself. Having established that covenant with himself, he then added a token to that covenant, and the token was circumcision. And I think we really pounded that over the last couple weeks to understand that that was a token and not necessarily a condition of the covenant. It's an unconditional covenant, and by that I mean the covenant will be established, the covenant will happen, the covenant will continue, and will be fulfilled on the basis of God's own promise to God's own word. It will not be established or annulled on the basis of people performing or not performing, because people aren't part of the covenant. People didn't have a part of the covenant to fulfill so that they could break the covenant. There had to be a human in the covenant for a human to disavow the covenant. But it was a covenant God made with himself. So God is going to perform everything God said he was going to perform, or else God is not true to his own word. And of course, throughout the Bible, we see that though we deny him, yet he is faithful. He cannot deny himself. It's like the one place in the Bible you ever see something God cannot do. He cannot deny himself. And of course, he will hasten his word to perform it. So the Bible is full of those kind of phrases. God is not a man that he should lie, nor the son of man that he should repent. Has he spoken and will he not do it? Has he said and will he not perform it? I mean, God will do everything he said. He's not like us. He's not men. He doesn't need to lie and he doesn't need to repent. Has he spoken? Will he not make it good? He will always do what he said he'll do. Now, what we saw last week was that that very same promise, using the very same language, was passed down to Isaac. Isaac finally came around when Abraham was 100 and his wife was 90. He was the child of promise. He had had a firstborn son who was 14 years old, roughly, when Isaac came around. That was Ishmael. Ishmael was the firstborn son. However, Ishmael was rejected by God. Ishmael was not the particular seed through which the blessing would flow, through which the covenant would flow, and through which the promised seed would come. God said who it would come through, and it came through the younger child, who was Isaac. Isaac then last week had twins, Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau were in Rebekah's stomach. God said there are two nations in your womb. And the first one was born Esau. Remember what I told you that means?
Red.
Red means red, right. And Jacob means heel catcher. You were just one person ahead. Because when the baby was born, the second child was hanging on to his heel. They struggled right up till the moment they were born for dominance. But God had told Rebekah, their mother, very specifically that the younger would have the dominance and the older would serve the younger. And last week we saw how the older one, Esau, sold his birthright for a mess of pottage. Basically some soup, some stew, some lentils. He was hungry and he sold his birthright. And we saw how they tricked old Isaac, nearly blind, sitting in there waiting to bless his child and give him the birthright. And he thought he was giving the birthright to his older child, but he in fact was giving it to the younger. He was giving it to Jacob, Because as God said, Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated. The elder child was rejected. And so he goes into the line of firstborn. But you'll notice in that line of firstborn that they're all those who were rejected. Now, the important thing here is the promise that was made to Abraham had a very particular lineage. And that particular lineage was going to pass down that promise from generation to generation to generation. And in these early generations, you're seeing how specifically this promise is moving. It's moving to a particular child. It's the younger child. And God is going back to each of these. We saw last week where God showed up to Jacob and established the exact same promise that he gave to Abraham using the exact same words that he used to Abraham. And when he promised it to Isaac and when he promised it to Jacob, he said to both of them, I'm establishing my covenant with you because of what your father Abraham did. He never put conditions on either of them. He simply said, I'm establishing it with you because of what your father already did. So if there ever was any kind of condition put on it, Abraham already fulfilled the condition. By the time it reached Isaac and Jacob, there's no way to say that it was a conditional promise. No condition was ever put on them. Jacob got the promise when he was at Bethel. He laid his head on the rock. You remember that story from last week? And he dreamed a dream where there was a ladder, Jacob's ladder, ascending and descending angels. And God came and spoke to him and gave him the very same promise, which included, I will give you this land, which included, through your seed, all the nations will be blessed. The exact same Abrahamic promise passed down yet again. This week, we're going to see what happens to Jacob. This guy, Jacob, this guy, heel catcher, this guy, supplanter, not a nice guy, not a good fella. And yet this is the guy who God is going to establish his covenant with and through. But first he has to change him. Jacob, this heel catcher, was running from his brother. Here's the background. He'd, of course, stolen through supplanting, through being a liar. He had stolen his brother's birthright. Now, yes, his brother had given the birthright away. Yes, his brother had said, you can have my birthright if you just give me something to eat. What good is it if I live and have the birthright? What good is it if I die? So I'll give you the birthright so I can live. So by all rights, his brother gave the birthright away. But what you'll see is that his brother came to his father immediately after Jacob had left the room. He showed up, Esau showed up and said, Father, I'm here. Here's the venison. Bless me. And he said, I've already given your blessing away. And it said that Esau pled with his father and cried with much tears, saying, no, give me the birthright. Give me what's rightfully mine. And he sought him with much crying, and he said, there's nothing I can do about it. I've spoken it, and I can't go back on it. God and everybody heard it, and your brother got the birthright. This is an interesting twist if you kind of want to get your theological brain engaged, because through supplanting, through trickery, Jacob managed to get exactly what God said he was going to get. Of the two, there was no good guy in this story. Jacob was a heel catcher and a supplanter, and that Esau was the profane person who gave away his birthright. There's no good guy here. But only through the electing grace of God was one of them chosen to continue this promise. So if you're going to say that somehow there were conditions to live up to keep the promise going, you got to find some condition Jacob kept for God to give him this blessing and keep working through him. And it doesn't exist. Jacob is a consistently pretty lousy guy, just like us. He's a consistent sinner and a consistent heel catcher and a consistent supplanter all the way through his life. And yet God, by sovereign mercy and grace, said, still, because I made a promise to your grandfather, I'm going to keep my promise through you, not because of you, but because of me and because of who I am and because I made a promise. I'm going to keep my promise. And that's really good news as you learn more and more about the character of God, because remember that the promise you're living under, the covenant you're living under, that God is going to forgive you for everything and take you to heaven to be with him, isn't based on you. It's based on a promise he made to your older brother. It's based on a promise he made to Christ. It's a promise that he made to Christ that he would have a people, wrote their name down, and you're in there. So if you're in there, my point is, you're in there. Jacob, no matter how hard he tried, couldn't mess up the plan of God. God got him anyway. You, no matter how hard you try, cannot mess up the plan of God. I know most of the people in this room pretty well, and I'm getting to know you better. And there's not a one of you in this room who hasn't at some time questioned to me whether you were really saved. Whether you were really, I don't know. Whether you've all had your doubts, you've all had your long talks, you've all had your moments. There's a couple that we haven't had the big in-depth, I don't know if I'm safe talk. But invariably it comes to the realization at the end of it that it's not up to you. Because if it were up to you, you'd be gone by now. If it were up to you, you'd have given up a long time ago. And if it were up to you to determine which of your works were good enough to keep you saved and keep you in the covenant of God, you would have given up on yourself, because you know yourself well enough to know that God ought to give up on you. Right? So the fact is, God makes covenants, and then he keeps covenants because of his own faithfulness to the covenant. He made a promise to his son that he would save you despite yourself for his son's glory. Not for your glory. Not because you did something so good or you're so special. And Jacob is a perfect point in case. Case in point. Pick a phrase. He's a perfect case in point. He did everything he could to mess it up. A heel catcher and a supplanter his whole life. And yet he ended up with the covenant. Even through trickery, he ended up being the proper descendant, exactly the way God predicted it would. God told his mother before he was born, he's the one who will get the birthright. And even though he, through trickery, ended up getting it from his father, he, by grace, got it from God. Before you were born, your trickery was well known. Before you were born, your supplanting nature was well known. But God still made a promise to his son, you get that one. And while you're going through your little life thinking you're being very tricky and very clever and trying to work it out yourself, it's actually God who foreordained the way you would work it out, so that you would end up exactly where he said you'd end up. And Jacob ended up exactly where God said he would end up, despite the fact that he thought he was going his own way and doing his own thing and being very clever. He and his mom both. Only in retrospect, when you're reading the scripture, do you see God's sovereign hand on the whole thing. While they were busy being tricky, God was busy being God. And they ended up exactly where they were supposed to be. But here's the interesting part of this story, as if that wasn't already interesting, is that he didn't just take the supplanter, the heel catcher, and say, okay, you're getting the promise anyway. First he gave him the promise, and then he changed him. That's part of the gospel story. Jesus does not just agree with God that they're going to get you. They agree they're going to get you, and then they change you. They start drawing you to themselves. The predestination that we like to talk about in the New Testament says that you are predestinated to what? Remember? To be conformed to the image of his son. Not just predestined to heaven, but predestined to be conformed into the image of his son. Predestination is a whole lot more than just, I chose you so you're going to heaven. It's, I chose you, you're mine, I will now make you act like you're mine. And you will. You'll buck and fight and catch heels and wrestle in the womb and everything else you got to do to try to not go that way. And you'll wrestle and wrestle and wrestle, and one day he'll beat you. And it'll be on exactly the day that he planned to beat you. Because he could have beaten you any time he wanted to. When God wants to win, he's going to win. But first he's going to give you enough time to get to know yourself and find out what you're really made of. Then you start running scared. Well, that's exactly where Jacob's at this point in the story, where we're going to pick it up. He found out that his brother was going to kill him. So he ran. He ran to Egypt. He hid. Well, while he was on the run, he got himself a wife. And in getting himself a wife, he got himself two wives. He loved Rachel, and he ended up with Leah. Which, by the way, is a very curious story. Have you ever put flesh and blood on that story? Because he comes to Laban, who is a farmer, who has a lot of flocks and sheep and stuff, and he says, I'm in love with your daughter Rachel, who's the younger daughter. And he says, well, you can work for her. And they make a deal that he'll work 7 years in exchange for Rachel. So he doesn't get to marry her. He doesn't get to consummate the marriage for 7 years while he works. So he starts working for Laban, and during the 7 years that he's working for Laban, God blesses him, and he becomes a pretty wealthy man and ends up with the majority of Laban's flock being his own. God just keeps blessing this guy. He's still a heel catcher. He's still a supplanter. God's taking care of him. So the night of his wedding comes, and they carry on a big party, and there's eating and there's drinking, and he goes to his tent, and his father says, I'll send Rachel right over, and into the tent he goes, and the father can't stand the fact that the younger daughter's getting married before the older one, so he sends Leah into the tent. Leah goes in, and they spend their conjugal evening together, and the sun rises, and the morning comes, and he wakes up and goes, hey, you ain't Rachel. That's not exactly a quote. He says, you're not Rachel, you're not who I want, you're Leah. And she said essentially, yeah, but we're married. Da, 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 da. So he goes back to Laban and says, well, you've tricked me. Oh yeah, Mr. Trickster? What exactly is your name? Mr. Supplanter, Mr. Heel Catcher? You're upset that I tricked you? Here's the deal. 7 more years, you can have my other daughter. So he worked 7 more years. He loved this woman so much, he worked 14 years to get this woman. Well, the one that he loved the most, Rachel, was also the one that was barren. She couldn't have kids. So she gave him her handmaiden. So he had kids with Leah. He had kids with Rachel's handmaid. He had kids with Leah's handmaid. He had conjugal visits with Rachel, but she never had a child. Well, after he was up to 11 kids through all the others, she, Rachel, cried out to God and said, my womb is closed, I'm barren, I can't have any kids, and I want my husband to love me. I want to be able to give him a son. I want to be able to give him a child. He loves the other 3 women he's had children with. He's close to them, but I don't have that relationship he has with the rest of them. I know he loves me, but I haven't had any kids. And an angel of the Lord opened her womb, and she had the youngest boy, Joseph. And Dad loved Joseph more than all the rest, because it was the one that he had with Rachel, the one he loved more than all the rest. So we'll get back to him in a minute. First, now we got to finish this change in Jacob. But I want you to get some feel for this guy. I mean, he's got a couple wives. He's got a couple handmaids. He's worked for 14 years just to get the 2 wives, and the other handmaids came with it. And he's now running. He's got his wives. He's got his handmaids. He's got his wealth that he got from Laban. He's got his boys. He's got a flock. He's got servants. He's got people. He's got riches. He's got all this stuff. And he hears that his brother is coming with an army. Remember the number? 4,000 armed men he was bringing with him? Coming to kill his brother. Well, that's enough to scare you. So he devises a plan. He gets his chief men together, and he devises a plan. And he says, here's what you're going to do first. You're going to drive a herd of sheep first, and then goats, and then oxen and cattle, and then men servants, and then maid servants, and you're going to drive them up to my brother, and you're going to say, this is a gift from your brother who loves you. Then, second wave, same deal, more flocks, more sheep, more cattle, more servants, gold, gifts, drive them up there and say, this is a gift from your brother, so that as he advances toward where I'm living, he keeps being stopped by these waves of gifts from me. Keeps getting stopped by these gifts. Meanwhile, while these waves of gifts are on their way to try to stop Esau from coming to kill him, he goes off on his own. And while he's alone, he meets a man. And that's what we're picking up. Yeah, I said Genesis 35, but it's 32. Let's start there. 32:1. Jacob went on his way, and the angel of God met him. And when Jacob saw the angel of God, he said, this is God's host. He called the name of the place Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother unto the land of Seir in the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, thus shall ye speak to my lord Esau when ye see him. Thy servant Jacob says thus, I have sojourned with Laban, and I have stayed there until now. I have oxen and asses and flocks, men servant, women servant, and I have sent to tell my lord that I have found grace in thy sight. In other words, first go tell your brother, look, I've been living with Laban all this time, and I'm rich. I got a lot of stuff. Maybe we can make a deal. And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, we came to thy brother Esau, and also he cometh to meet thee with 400 men with him. Oh, I said 4,000. I exaggerated. 400, that's what the number was. Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. So he divided the people that were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two bands. And he said, if Esau come to the one company and kill it, then the other company which is left shall escape. So his master plan was, he took everything he owned, divided them into two bands, and said, pretend you're the whole deal. And if he comes and destroys you, I'll still have at least half left. Pretty good plan. And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord which said to me, return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. I am not worthy of the least of thy mercies, and of all the truth which thou hast shown unto thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. As he was able to divide them into two huge armies, he just stood there and marveled at it and said, God of my fathers, I can't believe. I crossed over the Jordan and left my country with nothing but the stick in my hand. My walking stick is all I left with, and here I come back to my home, and look what I've become. Look at all the people and the flocks and the stuff that I've got. It's amazing what you've done for me. Verse 11, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and kill me and all the mothers with their children. And thou said, I will surely do thee good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. He's repeating the Abrahamic promise back to him and saying, you promised me that you were going to make my seed great, so don't let him come kill the seed. So he lodged there that same night. And he took of that which came to his hand a present for Esau's brother, 200 she-goats, 20 he-goats, 200 ewes, which are lambs, 20 rams, 30 milch camels with their colts, 40 kine with 10 bulls, that's cows and bulls, 20 she-asses and 10 foals. And he delivered them into the hands of his servants, every drove by themselves, and he said to his servants, pass over before me and put a space between drove and drove. In other words, first take up all the sheep, and then take up the goats, and then take up the cattle, and then take up the camels, and then so that they're in groups coming up in successive waves of gifts. He said, take these, pass over, go in front of me, and put a space between each drove and each drove. And he commanded the foremost, or the first drove, and said, when Esau my brother meets thee and asks thee, whose are these, and where are you going, and whose are these before thee, you will say, they be thy servant Jacob's. It is a present sent unto my lord Esau, and behold, also he is behind us. He's coming, but he sent you this gift first. And so he commanded then the second, and the third, and all the following droves, saying, on this manner shall ye speak unto Jacob when you find him. So the first drove would come with the shepherd that was driving him, and they'd come up and he'd say, what is this and whose are these? And they'd say, oh, it's yours. It's all from your brother, and he's coming. And then he'll say, well, that's nice, that's a good gift, to go a little further, and here'll come another drove of gifts. And he'll say, what's all this? Oh, this is yours. This is all from your brother, and he's back there, he's coming. And there'd be successive waves. He named five different waves right there of successive gifts that would come to him, making him wealthy in the doing. And say ye moreover, behold, thy servant Jacob is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. And afterward I will see his face. Peradventure he will accept me. So he went presently over before him, and he himself lodged that night in the company. Verse 22, and he rose up that night, took his two wives and his two women servants and his 11 sons, and he passed over the ford at Jabbok. And he took them, and he sent them over the brook, and sent over all that he had, and Jacob was left alone. And then this very cryptic phrase appears, and there he wrestled with a man until the breaking of the day. How peculiar is that? So he sends everybody over, tells everybody to move on, go to the other side of the brook, I'm going to stay here alone. And suddenly in the book of Genesis appears this man, unexplained, who for some reason wrestles all night with Jacob. Verse 25. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, that's a cryptic sentence, and when he, that's the man, saw that he prevailed not against him, Jacob, he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, the man said, let me go, for the day breaks. And Jacob said, I will not let thee go, except you bless me. And here's the blessing. He said to him, what is your name? And he had to admit, I'm Jacob. And in saying that, he was saying, I'm a heel catcher. I'm a supplanter. I'm a liar. I'm a trickster. I'm all that. That's my name. And he answered and said, your name will no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, or Israel. See that L at the end? You know that that's the name of God. It means prince that has power with God. Your name will be Israel, for as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and you have prevailed. Now let's stop there for a second. Theologians have debated and debated and debated what happened here. First off, I'll tell you right now, I believe that's a Christophany. It's a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. Christ does this. He shows up every time there's a big change in this promise. The Abrahamic promise that someday there would be a boy, and through that boy all the seed would come. Before that boy appeared, Melchizedek appeared. Melchizedek was Christ, and he blessed Abraham, and it was only after he blessed Abraham that Isaac was born. So the first seed that would produce the seed that would ultimately become Christ started with the blessing of Christ. I find that interesting. Jacob is about to become, his 12 seed are about to become the 12 tribes of Israel, the single nation that God will choose to himself out of all the nations of the earth. Those 12 tribes become the nation of Israel. And this blessing is going to continue to pass on through them. And in them and through them is going to come the single blessed seed, Christ. So before that happens, Christ shows up and blesses him. But first Christ shows up and changes him and says, you're not going to be a liar anymore, and you're not going to be a heel catcher anymore, and you're not going to be a trickster anymore, and you're no longer going to be named Jacob the heel catcher and the trickster and the supplanter. You're going to be called the prince that has power with God. What? How did a supplanter, a trickster, a liar, a cheat, how did this guy become prince who has power with God? Well, it happened when he met Christ. And it happened when he, just like the rest of us, wrestled with Christ for a while, wrestled in the darkness, and when the daylight came, David Morris made an interesting point. He said, isn't this funny to think about him wrestling with a man who is really Christ? How could you wrestle with Christ, and how could Christ not prevail? How could you hold on to him all night unless he wanted you to? Which I thought was a pretty interesting point. Clearly, Christ didn't want to break away. Clearly, Christ wanted him to keep clinging to him and wrestling with him until he got tired, until he gave up, until he just beat him down. Christ stayed and wrestled him down and wrestled him down. And finally he said, all right, it's the daybreak. Now let go of me. And he said, I won't let go until you bless me. Now, in the ancient Asian world where he's living, the greater always blesses the lesser. You never see the lesser blessing the greater. Whoever has the power is the one that blesses. So by saying, bless me, he's automatically saying, you're superior to me. Whoever you are, and as rich as this man was, this is Jacob, this is rich guy. But he recognized that whoever this man was that was wrestling with him was superior to him in every way and said, I won't let you go till you bless me. By the way, once you get a hold of Christ, don't let go. Don't let go till he blesses you. I like that. Because you know what the blessing will be? Change you. When he said, won't let you go till you bless me, what a great blessing. He said, guess what? Here's the blessing. You got cattle and you got sheep and you got stuff and you got children and you got women, you got all that stuff. The one thing you need is an internal change. The one thing you need is to stop being a liar and a heel catcher and a supplanter. The one thing you need is to be accepted before God. And it was Christ that created that acceptance. Changed him, changed his character, changed his name, made him a prince who had power with God, and did all that as a blessing. And said, your name will be Israel. Now, To this day, there's a nation over there called Israel, Israel. And people forget what that means. You hear it on the news all the time. There's bombing over in Israel. Every time you hear that, do you know what that means? Prince who has power with God. It still means what it always meant. Those are God's chosen people. Those are the people who God set his name on. The whole world from this point forward is divided into Israel, the promised people, and the Gentiles, the not promised people. The whole world. In God's view, in God's economy, and for the rest of the Bible, the whole world is divided into Israel, not Israel. And that's it. And you have to accept that, and you've got to learn that, and you've got to be educated in that to understand the rest of the Bible. If you don't know that, you can't understand why the Israelites were like they were and continue to be like they are. Because they know that. They know they are the only chosen people in the history of the world. They're the only chosen nation. They're the only chosen ethnic group. And they know it. And they have these promises. They have Abraham as their forefather, and they have this promise they're still clinging to. And they know that. So, he said to him, "What's your name?" He said, "Jacob." And he said, "Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and you have prevailed." And Jacob asked him and said, "Tell me, I pray thee, what is your name?" And he said, "Wherefore is it that you ask me after my name?" And he blessed him there. And he left. Isn't that interesting? How cryptic. He said, "Why is it that you ask me my name?" The implication is, you ought to know by now. You still don't know who I am? You don't know what I'm doing here? Talk about Abraham, your forefather. Figure out the promise. Figure out who I am that's blessing you and changing your name. Who has that kind of authority? What are you doing asking me who I am? And Jacob called the name of that place Peniel. And he said, "I have seen God face to face." Isn't that interesting? Now, in the New Testament, it says, no man has seen God, but Jesus Christ has revealed him, that he was the very image of him. His disciples came to him once and said, "Show us the Father, and it will suffice us." And he said, "Have I been so long with you, and you still ask to see the Father? Look at my face. You've seen God." When Jacob wrestled with this man, and he blessed him and changed his name, Jacob perceived, which, by the way, big point of perception, this man reached out, this wrestling man reached out and touched the side of his hip and made him lame. You don't think he could have won anytime he wanted? I mean, when you got that kind of trick up your sleeve, you're winning the wrestling match anytime you want. You know, oops, there goes your shoulder. Boom, there's no hip. I win. Clearly, he stayed with him all night because he wanted to stay with him all night. Clearly, he wrestled with him all night because he wanted to wrestle with him all night. And first, he wanted to take the fight out of him. Wrestle with him all night until he got tired and weak and I've had enough wrestling. Isn't that the way you were? Maybe some of you still are. Still in the wrestling phase. Getting tired of it, getting tired of it. Well, you know when the wrestling match stops? When he reaches out and changes how you walk. That's what he did to him. Touched the hollow of his hip, and from that day forward, the man limped. And everybody, whoever saw the man limping down the street, would have to say, "What happened to you?" He'd have to say, "I met God and he changed me. And now I walk different. I met God face to face in the face of Jesus Christ. He wrestled with me. He changed my name and my inward parts, and I walk differently now." What are we, 32 chapters into Genesis? How many times have we seen the gospel so far? Geez, just written all over the place. Now, that's the same guy you're wrestling with. Whenever he's done wrestling with you, he'll just change you. He'll change your walk. He'll make you lame. He'll make it so that you can't stand up so high and proud. First, he's going to humble you and take you down, and then he's going to exalt you. First, he's going to take you low, then he'll lift you up. That way, you know it was him doing it. Right? Our flesh would naturally want to say, "I did it. I get to boast and brag." He made sure through all of this that he did every part of it. He met him. He was by himself. The man came and met him. Then he engaged him in a wrestling match. Then he said, okay, it's morning, we're done. And when he said, oh, no, I'm not done, he said, yeah, you are. Reached out and made him lame. There, you're done. Then he said, now admit what you are. What's your name? And he had to admit, man, I'm sinner. That's my name. I'm heel catcher. I'm liar. I'm cheat. I'm deceiver. That's me. That's who I am. He said, okay, now lame, beaten up, wrestled to the ground, liar, sinner, cheat. I got good news for you. That's not what you're going to be anymore. It's not what you're going to be called anymore. Now you're a prince that has power with God. And he said, well, then tell me your name. If you've done all this to me, man, who are you? That's the natural next question. So he passed over Penuel, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. In other words, he stumbled. He couldn't walk anymore. He walked as a halt man, as a lame man the rest of his life. He couldn't walk on that thigh anymore because God had changed his walk. Therefore, the children of Israel, eat not of the sinew, which is the shank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh, unto this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh in the sinew that shrank. So when Jesus reached out and touched his thigh, it shrank the muscle in his thigh. Have you ever had a muscle cramp up on you? So what happened is the muscle in the hollow of his thigh cramped up on him. He had to walk like that the rest of his life. And that was such an important event to the Israelites that for the rest of their life, in any animal they ate, they would never eat the sinew of the thigh because that was holy. That was separate. You didn't eat that because God touched Israel's thigh. So then in chapter 33, you're going to see that Jacob meets up with Esau. If you want to know the story, Jacob lifted up his eyes and he looked. Now don't forget, he has just met Christ. Christ has blessed him, changed his name to Israel. He's got the Abrahamic promise on him. Through him is going to come the seed through which all the worlds are going to be blessed. Christ is going to come through his family and seed. So he can't die, can he? He's safe now. Jacob lifted up his eyes and he looked, and behold, Esau came with the 400 men, and he divided the children unto Leah and unto Rachel and unto the two handmaids, and he put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph were in the hindermost, and he passed over before them, and he bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. What happened there? Esau was out to kill him. Esau, his enemy, was out to kill him. His own brother was out to kill him. But after he had met Christ and the blessing of Christ was on him, nobody could touch him. And God changed his mind. God, by the way, sovereign God that we talk about, he's not just sovereign over the church and his own elect. He's sovereign over absolutely everybody. Absolutely everybody. And he can change the mind of a heathen as fast as he can change yours. And he changed Esau's mind completely and protected him because that was his own. That's interesting. Why have you lived this long? Anybody ever been in a situation where you went, that was close. If I hadn't looked up right then, that train would have hit me. If I had left 5 minutes earlier, I'd have been in that accident. If I hadn't looked up at that moment, I'd have gone right off the road. Why is that? It's because sovereign God is working on your behalf, making sure and changing things and ordering things to take care of you. If you're his and you don't know him, he'll keep you alive long enough to introduce himself to you. Once he's introduced himself to you, he'll keep you alive as long as it takes to get you to do the work he's got for you to do. And when the work is done, he'll take you home to himself. He gets all the glory in all this. There's no such thing as luck. Things don't just happen. It's not just good fortune. It's the providence of God protecting you, taking care of you. And sure was lucky he had all that stuff to put in front of Esau. Sure was lucky that in marching toward him, Esau decided to change his mind. Well, what was the 400 armed men for? He was out to kill his brother when God changed him. Now, so he's got these 11 kids. Israel now does. His name has been changed to Israel, and he's got his 11 kids. And he prefers Joseph. Prefers Joseph so much that you probably know from Andrew Lloyd Webber the story of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. There you go. and the other boys hated Joseph because they were all there first. And if anybody was supposed to get the birthright, it was Reuben, the firstborn. Born to Leah, proper born to the first wife, the oldest, he should be getting everything from his dad. Joseph began to have dreams. Joseph and dreams are tightly wound throughout his whole career in the Bible. Joseph had, his first dream was that there were a bunch of sheaves of wheat, and that his was the superior sheave of wheat, and all the other sheaves bowed down, and that there were 12 sheaves of wheat, the other 11 bowed to his. And so he told his dad and his brothers and everybody, which of course they just greeted the news with great joy, that that they would all bow down before him. And then he had another dream of the sun and the moon and 11 stars, but that they all did obeisance to his star. So he told his dad and mom that one, and his dad freaked out and said, "Are you saying that your mother and I and all your brothers are going to bow down before you?" And he said, "Well, you know, it's my dream. What can I tell you?" So the boys one day decided it was time to kill their brother. There's a lot of that going on. They took him out and decided to kill him, but fortunately at the last minute, Reuben spoke up, the eldest, and said, "You know, let's not just utterly kill him. Let's just throw him in a pit, and we'll take this coat that Dad likes so much, and we'll throw some animal blood on it. And we'll take it back and we'll say he was torn up by wild animals. And here's the coat that proves it. And then what we'll do is we'll just leave him in a pit. And that way we haven't actually killed him. He'll either live or die depending on how it goes." So they threw him into a pit. But at the same time that he happened to like go into the pit, there was a passing band. They saw him in the pit and said, "What do you plan to do with him?" And they said, "Oh, he's a slave. You can have him if you want." And they sold him. Sold their brother into slavery and off he went. And they took the coat back to their father and said, "Oh, it's terrible. He was torn up by animals. Look at the blood. Oh, it was awful." So poor Jacob, poor Israel, decides that his youngest son, the one he loves most, is dead. Well, now remember that way back when, back here with Abraham, Abraham had asked the question, "How will I know that I'm going to inherit this land?" And the answer he got was that God spelled out the next several hundred years of human history, and it included that his descendants were going to go into a land where they weren't known, and they were going to be slaves there for 400 years, come out richer than when they went in. So this is the beginning of God keeping that segment of the promise and getting the seed of Abraham into Egypt, which is going to be the land where they're going to go into slavery. In order to get them there, first he got Joseph there. He sold him into slavery, and he went to work in Potiphar's house. He becomes the chief of the house. He's a really good worker. He's a really good guy. He's really honest. He's taking care of all the business dealings for Potiphar. Potiphar's a wealthy governor, kind of prince sort of fellow, well known. Unfortunately, he had a wife that was a little less than scrupulous, who had an eye on Joseph, because Joseph was a young, good-looking fella. And she kept coming to Joseph and saying, "You know, look, when the husband's gone, you just come on and meet me in the bedroom. We'll have at it." And he kept saying, "No, I don't plan to do that." So one day she's laying on her couch and she beckons for Joseph, and he comes in and she says, "Come and lay with me on the couch." And he says, "No, it's not going to happen." So she grabs his robe. He's wearing one of those wraparound toga type robes. She grabs it and gives it a good yank, and the belt comes off and the robe comes off, and he runs naked out of the house. And as Joseph's running naked out of the house, she screams rape. The guards descend on Joseph, and next thing he knows, he's in the dungeon. So he went from, "Gee, this is working out pretty well. Hey, I'm all the way up in Potiphar's house. Hey, I've got control of the whole house. I'm taking care of all the business. I'm top dog here, second only to my boss." Dungeon! So he's rotting in prison. And while he's rotting in prison, there's a cupbearer that used to work for Pharaoh. And there was also a baker down there who, for one reason or another, had been sent down into the prison. So the three of them are down there rotting in prison, and they start talking about their dreams, and they start telling each other their dreams. And Joseph interprets the dreams and says to the baker, "Well, you're going to die. That's bad news." Says to the cupbearer, "You're going to be returned to Pharaoh. And when that happens, remember me down here." So sure enough, the baker's killed. The cupbearer starts thinking, "Hey, the baker died. This guy's not bad." And sure enough, he's returned to his station as the cupbearer. And time goes by, and Joseph's rotting in prison, and Pharaoh starts having bad dreams. Now, this, of course, is all by the providence of God. Sovereign God decides it's about time to give bad dreams to Pharaoh. Pharaoh's not a believer. They worship the sun and they worship idols, but he still sovereignly intercedes on this man's life and manages to give him some bad dreams. So Pharaoh calls in all his people and he says, I've had a bad dream. I've had a bad dream. And the cupbearer goes, hey, wait a minute. There's this guy rotting in your prison at this very moment who interpreted dreams for me and the baker, and he was completely right. Maybe he can help you out. And Pharaoh says, go get that guy out of prison, whoever he is. Out of the pit comes Joseph. They clean him up, wash him up, dress him up, and put him in front of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh says, I've had this dream, and I was looking at the river Nile, and these big, fat, healthy, plump cows came up out of the Nile. And then behind them, seven other cows that were just skinny and lean and malnourished and looking sickly and looking bad. And the skinny, sick cows ate the big, fat cows. What's that mean? And Joseph has said, God has revealed to you what's going to happen for the next 14 years here in Egypt. Pharaoh sat up and took notice. He said, really? He says, yeah, there's going to be 7 years of wealth, food, bumper crops. It's going to come in. Everything's going to be great. Plenty to eat. Fatness of the land, great for 7 years. After that, 7 years of famine. Nothing to eat. He says, what do you think we ought to do? And Joseph says, well, if it were me, for the 7 good years, I'd be storing stuff up. For the 7 good years, I'd be putting stuff away. For the 7 good years, I would make sure that we had plenty to eat through the 7 tough years. Pharaoh goes, good plan, you do it. He gets Pharaoh's ring. He sits second only to Pharaoh in the whole place. He has the authority of Pharaoh to take whatever he needs to take from the people. Tax them, take in the food, do whatever you got to do. And he's working on the authority of Pharaoh. So this guy went from the top of Potiphar, the governor's house, into the prison, hung out in the prison for years, and went right from there to second only to Pharaoh. All in the providence of God. Well, as the 7 years went on, he starts collecting from people. He starts collecting and putting away and collecting and putting away, and he's got all this stuff in store. And by the end of the 7 years of bumper crops, he's got silos and barns to keep it all in. And Pharaoh now has this huge store of food. And the famine comes. And the famine comes, and everybody eats what they've got left, and then they know the only place to go is to Pharaoh to get stuff. So they bring money to Pharaoh, and they buy food. When they run out of money, Joseph starts making deals and says, all right, I'll take your cattle, I'll take your lambs, take your sheep, I'll take your stuff. They say, okay, they start bringing cattle, and pretty soon he owns all the cattle, all the lambs, all the sheep, all the animals in Egypt are all belonging now to Pharaoh in exchange for food. Well, after they run out of that, they start coming and saying, well, what about our homes? What about our land? What about our... He starts taking homes and land and everything else in exchange for food. And finally they come and say, we'll sell ourselves into servitude for food. So they sell themselves, and pretty soon Pharaoh is not just the ruler, he's the absolute owner of everyone and everything at Joseph's hand. Pharaoh likes Joseph. Pharaoh thinks Joseph's the best because Pharaoh now owns everything in Egypt. Well, meanwhile, the famine had spread all the way into Canaan, and Jacob and his boys, Israel and his boys, are starving to death. So they say, there's food in Egypt. We hear there's grain and there's food in Egypt. We'll go up and see if we can't get some. So they head all the way up to Egypt, and the only one they leave behind, now you got to know that there was a 12th boy born. There were the 11 boys. Joseph was the 11th. Meanwhile, Rachel, the second time, bore another child, and she bore Benjamin, the young one. And in the heart of Jacob, this Benjamin was the replacement for Joseph. It was the only other child he had had by Rachel. And it was his youngest, so he loved Benjamin more than the rest. So the boys, the older boys, go up to Egypt to go see if they can find some food. And who do you think they stood before? Old, dead, left him in a pit, Joseph. But they don't know who he is. He's got the big Egyptian crown on. He's got the Egyptian eye paint on. Looking good and healthy and tan and sitting there in the Egyptian robe, sitting up there on the throne by Pharaoh's. And they come up and they desperately need food, and they come up and do exactly what he predicted they would do. They come and bow down in front of him. God was right. God predicted it. It's all true. They come and bow down before him and say, look, we've come looking for food. We've got no food. And they tell him about the family. And so he starts asking questions. Joseph's sitting up there and says, because he recognizes them. He knows who they are. They're bowing down in front of him. Their lives are in his hands. He can feed them or not feed them. Suddenly these guys who have betrayed him and left him for dead are all sitting in front of him. He has the right at that moment to say, kill these guys. He looks at him and says, tell me about your family. And they tell him about their old father back there in the land of Canaan. And he's excited to hear that his dad's still alive. So he's so excited to hear about dad being alive that he says, and is there really just all of you or is there yet another one? And they say, well, we have a younger brother, Benjamin, but oh, you know, gee, our dad loves him. And after he lost his other youngest, he never let him go. So he's at home with dad. So he says, okay, I'll give you food if you bring Benjamin up here to see me. Because it was the only other son that was born by his mother, Rachel. That was his only real brother. These all betrayed him, but not Benjamin. Benjamin was born afterwards. That was his only real brother in the family. And he said, bring me the youngest. So they bring him the youngest. They go back and they tell their father, look, he'll feed us. He gave us some grain to come back here with, and he'll feed us, but we got to take Benjamin. And dad freaks out and says, you can't take Benjamin. I've lost my youngest before. I've lost Joseph, my only child, by Rachel. You can't take Benjamin. He says, well, fine, then we all die. So finally, Reuben comes forward and says, look, here's the deal. You let me take him, and if anything happens to him, you kill me over it. He says, all right, you take him, but you bring that boy back to me. So off they go. They go back to Egypt and they take Benjamin with them. Now Joseph has done all this to figure out what kind of guys these boys have grown up to be. Because he knows, the last thing he knows of them is they left me in a pit and they're going to do the same thing to my baby brother. So he's going to find out what kind of fellas he's dealing with. And he tells his servants, load them up with grain. Give them everything you get. They can't believe the kindness. He dresses them. He sits them at a table. He gives them a feast. He just really takes care of them. They can't believe what's going on. This is great. Loads them up with grain and then takes one of his servants aside. Says, take my cup, my private cup, my gold cup. You take it and you put it in one of those bags and you put it on Benjamin's donkey and you send them off. And they say, okay, so off they go with the cup that belongs to Joseph. They just stole from him. And off they go, traipsing across. They open the bag and they discover the cup. Uh-oh. We couldn't be in bigger trouble. We are all going to prison now. They come back to Joseph and say, we've got this cup. We don't know how we got this cup. We didn't mean to take this cup. And the brothers come before Joseph and say, if this boy is not returned to our father, it will kill our father. And we would rather that you take us, make us your indentured servants, kill us, but by all means, don't do anything to this boy. That boy's got to go back to our father. And that's when Joseph realized that really they were okay guys and they loved Benjamin protecting him. And it says that he took off the hat, took off the makeup, and he said, guess who? And it says they just fell on his neck and he hugged them all and he kissed them all and he said, here's what I want you to do, boys. Go get dad. Bring him up here. They're thrilled. They can't stand it. The guy on the throne who has all the food who's ruling Egypt is Joseph. How good is this? So they all run back and they tell their dad, Joseph's not dead. Guess what? He's like Pharaoh now. So dad comes up and he gives each of his brothers an area called Goshen, an area in Egypt, and he makes them princes and rulers over areas of Egypt. And they become what's known as the Hyksos, the shepherd kings. To this day, you go to Egypt, you'll hear them curse and swear and spit about Hyksos. To this day, the Egyptians hate shepherd kings. The Israelites were the rulers in Egypt. Well, anyways, comes time for old Jacob to die. He goes to Joseph and he says, promise me this one thing. Do not bury me here. I don't want to be buried in Egypt. Promise me when I die, you'll take me back to Canaan and you bury me in Canaan, the promised land. That's where I want to be buried. So he makes him the promise. Yeah, that's good. That's what's going to happen. So it comes time for him to give away the blessing. He's going to die, and it's time for him to give away the birthright blessing. And he says to Joseph, bring me the two sons that you have borne while you're here in Egypt. Now remember this for a moment. These two boys are half Egyptian. Joseph has an Egyptian wife. So these are half-breeds going out the gate. Two half-Egyptian, half-Hebrew boys. I am in chapter 48 of Genesis. Did all that to catch you up. A lot of ground. Covered a big chunk of history there. It came to pass after these things. These things are everything I just told you. This is Genesis 48. It came to pass after these things that one told Joseph, behold, your father is sick. So he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And one told Jacob and said, behold, thy son Joseph comes unto thee, and Israel, that's Jacob, strengthened himself, and he sat upon his bed. And Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan, and he blessed me. And he said unto me, behold, I will make thee fruitful and multiply thee. I will make of thee a multitude of people, and will give this land to thy seed after thee for an everlasting possession. Does that sound familiar? He said, I am the heir of the Abrahamic promise. And he's repeating the promise. And he said, now your two sons, these half-Egyptian boys, Ephraim and Manasseh, which were born unto you in the land of Egypt, before I came unto thee into Egypt, these two boys, he says, are mine. Even as Reuben and Simeon are mine, these two shall be mine. And thy issue, which you beget after them, shall be mine. And they shall be called after the name of their brethren in their inheritance. In other words, he's saying, don't raise these boys to be Egyptians. Raise these boys to be Hebrews. And I am claiming them into our family. And they are now going to be as much mine as Reuben and Simeon are mine. They are part of the family now. As for me, when I came from Paddan, Rachel died by me in the land of Canaan in the way. And when yet there was but a little way to come unto Ephrath, I buried her there on the way to Ephrath. And that same place is called Bethlehem. He said, I buried Rachel, your mom, in Bethlehem. And Israel beheld Joseph's two sons, looking through his cloudy eyes because he can barely see. By the way, the man that we're talking about right here, 140. So his eyes are a little cloudy. He said, so who are these? And Joseph said to his father, these are my sons, whom God has given me in this place. And he said, bring them, I pray thee, unto me, and I will bless these boys. He's about to hand down the blessing. Now, he didn't say, bring me Reuben, the firstborn. He said, bring me the sons of Joseph. And then he repeated the Abrahamic blessing. He said, now bring me the boys and I'm going to bless them. He jumped right over Reuben. He jumped right over a whole generation. And he went to the two half-Egyptian sons of Joseph. Talk about election. My goodness. So the eyes of Israel were dim for age so that he could not see. And he brought them both near unto him, and he kissed them, and he embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, I had not thought that I would even see your face. And lo, God has shown me also your seed or your children. And Joseph brought them out from between his knees, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth. Joseph took them both. Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and he brought them near to him. Now, Manasseh's the older, Ephraim's the younger. The right hand is the hand of blessing, so he lined them up accordingly. He put Manasseh, his eldest, on his left side, and he put Ephraim, his youngest, on his right side, and he took them up to his father so that when his father reached out to bless him, the right hand of blessing would fall on the eldest, Manasseh. But have we ever seen the eldest get the blessing anywhere yet? Nope. So Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, Manasseh at his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and he brought them near, and Israel stretched out his right hand, and he laid it on Ephraim's head. He reached the wrong way. He knew where they were and who they were. He knew if he put his hands out straight, he'd be on the oldest head, and he reached out and put his hand on Ephraim's head, who was the younger. at his left hand, he put on Manasseh's head. And it says he was guiding his hands wittingly. For Manasseh was the firstborn. In other words, he reached out on purpose and went this way. And guided his hands cleverly. And he blessed Joseph and he said, God, before whom my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, did walk, the God which fed me all the days of my life, the angel which redeemed me from all evil. By the way, who was the angel that redeemed him from all evil?
Christ,
the man he wrestled with all night. Sure, absolutely. The angel that redeemed me from all evil, bless these lads. Let my name be named on them. And the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. And when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on Ephraim and had begun the blessing, it displeased him. And he grabbed his dad's hands and he lifted him off to remove them from Ephraim's head unto Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, not so, father, for this is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. And his father refused and said, I know. His father refused and said, I know it, my son, I know it. He also shall become a people. And he also shall be great, but truly his younger brother will be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations. And he blessed them that day, saying, in thee shall Israel bless, saying, God make thee as Ephraim and as Manasseh. And he set Ephraim before Manasseh. And Israel said unto Joseph, behold, I die, but God shall be with you and bring you again unto the land of your fathers. Did you catch that? You're going back to Canaan. Sure, you think you're Mr. Egyptian boy right now. Sure, you're sitting on the throne of Egypt and have set up your brothers as the rulers of these 12 tribes. But I'll tell you this, the promise of God is you're going to inherit that land of Canaan. So I'll tell you this, I'm dying, but you're going back to Canaan. Whether it's you or your kids after you, trust me, God said you're going to Canaan. So believe me when I tell you, you're going to Canaan. You might be Mr. Wealthy Guy, second only to Pharaoh, sitting up there on the throne right now. But trust me, you're going to Canaan. Moreover, I have given to thee one portion above all thy brethren, which I took out of the hand of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow. So now Jacob calls all his sons together to give them a blessing. So Jacob called unto his sons, said, gather yourselves together, and I will tell you that which will befall you in the last days. So he's got the 12 boys together, and he's going to hand out blessings. These blessings are going to be the first place that you're going to see the division in the Abrahamic promise. And that's where we'll pick up next week. I'm going to go easy on you. I can see everybody going, oh, my brain, ow. Next week, you're going to see the next generation come around, and you're going to see the significance of Ephraim and Manasseh, particularly Ephraim, and we're going to talk about the 12 tribes and how the 12 tribes get out of Egypt and end up, just like he said, right back in Canaan, where they're supposed to be in the first place. The point of all this is you're finally going to see the law enter, and when the law enters, you're going to see that it did not do away with the Abrahamic covenant. And if it didn't do away with the Abrahamic covenant, it didn't do away with the token of the Abrahamic covenant. And then we're going to go back to Romans, because then you'll be able to understand Paul's argument. Okay?
So what happens to Joseph's little brother?
Benjamin?
Yes.
Benjamin gets some blessings. He's going to curse a few boys. He's going to bless a few boys. Benjamin becomes part of Judah. And Benjamin and Judah become the southern kingdom. So we're going to get to all that next week. But do you see what's happening here? See what's happening every time? There's always an elder that gets passed over. The elder brother gets passed over, and the younger brother gets the blessing. And every time, the blessing is through election, through grace, to those who don't deserve it. Never according to the one who deserves it, who's the firstborn. The one who deserves it and wants it by desert and wants to be able to get it because of his fleshly rights never gets it. But the younger one, who doesn't deserve it, isn't expecting it, and is usually not that good a guy, gets the blessing every time through election. So don't tell me Paul started this concept of election. Boy, it runs rampant over here. Isn't it clear? Yes. And Paul's going to use this very example in Romans to say that God has always, always elected. So that's why you need to know all this. So when Paul says it, you won't be asking, what's the history behind that, Paul? You'll know.